We're playing Bowie on a snowy Tuesday. It must be the day after a fun drive. Good morning, everybody. Welcome. It is Tuesday, the 12th of February, and we are delighted to have you all with us. We, quite frankly, didn't know if we were going to have a show today because we figured perhaps the fun drive would dribble into today or maybe even tomorrow, but it didn't. It ended, and so thank you very much. We'll get to that in just a second, and thank you all proper-like. Let me introduce our wonderful panel who have are all locally based and were able to make it in today, even though it hasn't started yet, but it probably will while we're talking. J.P. Miller is here. He is the man behind the Empire Report, and he joins us every Tuesday, and he is with us this Tuesday. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Joe, good morning. I'm great. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. Mike Spain is with us, the newly retired editor of the Times Union. I was telling Mike one of my favorite comments of the fun drive yesterday was I love the fun drive especially on Tuesdays when that former editor fellow from the Times Union is on. There you go.
And congratulations on that.
Yes, congratulations.
Thank you very
much. Quite impressive.
And then there is Judy Patrick, who is here, and we are thrilled. She is the VP of Editorial Development for the New York Press Association, a longtime editor of the Daily Gazette, and we welcome her to the program this morning. Hello.
It's great to be here. You know, I remember covering media, and I remember covering fund drives at WAMC that lasted as long as a week. Those days are gone, huh?
Oh, Alan, you remember more than a week.
We remember almost 2 weeks, to be honest with you, and Judy, and I remember you were covering them because, you know, you looked like Brenda Starr, girl reporter. You were terrific.
There you go. You know.
Yes.
I was going to say it was yesterday. It was 12 hours, and then, you know, the lockbox, of course. We can't underestimate the lockbox. I mean, who would have thunk that today we'd be here and be ready to go with a full show? And but it was all very nice, wasn't it, Alan?
It was sensational. It was so reaffirming of what we have come to expect from our group. I mean, they were really there. Everybody was there. And when we went on, Joe, you and I, just before we knew we could come back today, and we did the whole thing in 12 hours. That's extraordinary. But when we came in, we said, listen, we have a real problem. It's going to snow like crazy tomorrow. And the volunteers are already calling in saying they can't come. And the staff won't be able to hear. So could you help us out? And help us out they did. And we finished it in 12 hours. Extraordinary. Not to brag, but that's pretty extraordinary.
Oh, I think you should brag the hell out of that.
Well, not only that, but we have a great panel this morning. I love our panel this morning. Everybody is fantastic. Judy's great, and JP's great. He didn't bring his cousin PJ, but
you know what? I will say that as we were talking about doing the fun drive in 12 hours, but 12 hours ago, none of these people thought they were going to be on a show. So that even goes.
Oh, is that right?
That's even nicer.
Yeah,
that they come we thought we'd get a week off. Yeah.
One of the things about Joe, which we will all admire the most, is his ability to get such quality on this program.
Well,
I mean, it's unbelievable how he reaches out, and he does it. He's great.
Well, thank you. We have great people, and they were all on standby, and it was very nice, and we reached out, and they quickly said yes. They're very committed, and we thank everybody for doing it. And thanks, of course, just to echo what Alan just said, but thank you to everybody who made the fun drive such a quickie and just a lovely, lovely experience for all involved. So thank you very, very much. All right. Well, we have stuff to talk about. As I was compiling stories yesterday and thinking about what we talk about this morning, it was everybody was huddling at the Capitol and trying to figure out what was going to happen. And then all of a sudden, whoa, the white smoke came from the from the chimney. And we have an agreement, apparently. Something's going on. So let's talk about that. We know that there is a tentative deal that has been reached to keep the government open, and guess what? It does not include full wall funding. Congressional negotiators agreed in principle to provide $1.3 billion for fencing, not a wall, not a slat, fencing, and other physical barriers of the Mexican border, far less than what President Trump has demanded. The deal must still pass the House and the Senate and secure Mr. Trump's signature. He said Monday night, we're building the wall anyway. In fact, the mission accomplished banner that they had up over his rally last night in El Paso, Texas, was not build the wall, finish the wall. Finish the wall. So that is a brief outline of where we are right now. It's going to be a very busy day on Capitol Hill. Alan, what do you think is going to happen? What do we make of this?
Well, first of all, I think we can all agree that Donald Trump could not. He had to blink here. And we hope he has, because he was told by McConnell and the senior Republicans that they couldn't take the heat of a continued mess over the wall. And 1.3 is different than 5 point something. And he has indeed blinked. Now the real problem will become if he decides to do this by executive order. Because truly, that is the pathway to fascism, the idea that you don't need a Congress to make decisions. You just make them yourself and say, eat it to them. And that's where I think this could become very dangerous. And if there's anybody standing who doesn't think that he's capable of doing that, think again.
The interesting thing about this is that when you – exactly what you were just talking about, Alan – of going ahead with a plan, and I know it's appeasing the base, but you know, no one is on board on this so far, and if he had taken the original deal, he would have gotten more than he got out of this arrangement, and that is fascinating to me.
And I think we all understand that it has nothing to do with the substance of the deal.
Correct.
It has to do with throwing those red stakes to the people who were behind him, to his group.
And I do think we still have a long way to go towards actually having this deal signed by the president. But I'm impressed with the congressional Democrats that they are approving $1.4 billion for some fencing. I think before they said that they weren't going to approve anything. So I think that they are giving something that's going to be painful for them. And then also President Trump is giving something painful in that he's only going to get 55 miles, I think it's reported, of border fencing when he wanted significantly more. I do think that they have he has a lot of incentive not to lead to another shutdown right now.
Well, you know, JP, one of the things that is fascinating about this deal is the idea that they came up with it at a time when Trump's numbers theoretically are going up. Go figure that. I can't. The Rasmussen poll, which I think we can all agree, maybe not that we can all agree, but I certainly think it's true, is the best poll a Republican can buy, has him over 50% for the first time. And there is something going on here that I don't quite understand. I don't trust the Rasmussen poll. I have never trusted it, but that's what they're saying. And maybe he thinks he can weather it.
I think that the negotiations that were going on late last week, where it was leaked out that they had come to an agreement, and then on Sunday afternoon it sort of fell apart. And it was over the issue of how many detention beds the ICE could maintain. The Democrats were arguing if that number was too high, it would allow ICE to incarcerate people who are completely law-abiding and here trying to get proper paperwork to be here in the U.S. and work and pay taxes, et cetera, and that it wouldn't just be for the criminals, the ones that Trump scares everybody about. And the Democrats were looking like they were trying to get too much. They gave in on that overnight. And on Monday, there was an agreement. And now Trump's challenge is to make the optics look like he won and that he's presidential on this. And already you hear people like Lindsey Graham saying, well, this is a good down payment on the wall. And, when they use a term like border barrier, It's something that is completely parsed, where the Democrats can say that's a fence and Trump can say that's a wall. And the trouble is, his number one advisor, the Fox News commentator, Sean Hannity, has already called this a garbage compromise. So we don't know what's going to happen this week.
Yeah, I think that's Trump's big challenge now, is to deal with what I consider this new branch of government, the Sean Hannity, Ann Coulter branch of government, where they whisper in his ear, and they're very influential, and he could cave if they speak loud enough and strongly enough. I agree with Mike about the optics. I wish people wouldn't be pointing out that President Trump is a loser, because he listens to that, and we could just say, yes, President Trump, you're going to get your wall, and we're going to tell everybody else that it's a fence. If we just, you know, if we could scale back on the declaration that this is a major defeat for him, that would be in everybody's best interest.
And at the same time, we have Beto O'Rourke, right, out there yesterday having a competing rally with that of Trump. O'Rourke's appeal was that here we are in a city that had a declining crime rate until he put up a system of wall here. And it's pretty convincing, at least to me it is.
Yeah, I mean, you're relying on data, facts, research that took place and is documented. That's a problem here, Alan.
Yeah, we don't want that.
Oh, that.
I just wish that you could have, like Judy was saying, you know, you could have on Fox News, you could call it a wall, and on MSNBC, you could call it a border barrier, and that they wouldn't point out on Fox News that this is kind of the deal. It's a little less than the deal that was all worked out in December before he forced the shutdown, Trump forced the shutdown on Fox, but you could say it on MSNBC, and then everybody would be happy and we'd keep the government open.
You know, it seems that I was just struck by what JP said earlier about, you know, the Democrats have to have a little pain in this. But boy, they have a lot less pain than I think they thought they were going to have, right? I mean, even on the original deal, they're given less in now than they did okay on this. And also, it seems we have no idea where this deal is going to go. We have no idea how the word on Capitol Hill right now is that everyone is just bracing to see how the president responds to this. The official response from the White House is that they're still reading through it. But the question being, as of right now, well, bipartisanship worked.
Yes, it did.
Imagine that.
It did, and I think that to get bipartisanship, you have to have each side feeling a little pain, and certainly Trump is going to be disappointed that he's not getting more wall. And Nancy Pelosi, who said no wall, no fence, no how, all of a sudden she now has agreed or might agree to 55 miles of new fencing and $1.4 billion. I'm sure that she and the people in her base are not going to be excited about that either. But
they're studying the polls, that's for sure. When you say bipartisan, JP, yeah, that's right. But they're not doing it for the sake of the bipartisanship. They're both sides are looking at what they have to lose. The Democrats, of course, think they have a lot to lose, A, because of what I just mentioned. For some strange reason, Trump's polls seem to be going up. And B, they know that they can't afford a shutdown. And the Republicans certainly know that. That's why they dispatched Mitch McConnell to the president to say, can't do this, no can do. We'll lose our seats if we continue with this.
You know, we're missing the forest for the trees, because we really aren't having a substantial conversation about what this country wants in terms of immigration. Who do we want to admit? Why do we want to admit? I mean, that has been entirely lost among the demonization of people coming in from Mexico and the South. So we never have that conversation anymore, and we should.
You know, I keep thinking of the revolt of the body snatchers. Remember that picture in which people...
One of my favorite movies.
People just would disappear.
No wonder you can't sleep at night. Don't watch those movies.
Well, it's not so funny when it's somebody you love and respect in your town, and all of a sudden the ice swoops down and they're gone. And I think a lot of people have been experiencing that. It causes great consternation. It sort of reminds me a little bit of the early 1930s and what was happening in Germany. people would disappear. And that, I think, is why it is so important to remember that the subtext, as you guys have raised up until now, was how many beds for detention. Because the more beds, the more people are going to disappear.
You know, it's sad, as Judy was alluding to, there was a thoughtful discussion, bipartisan agreement back in 2014, yep. The Gang of Eight, where Chuck Schumer and Marco Rubio and I mean, people from both sides came up with a good plan that had strong bipartisan support, and that was submarined, basically, by torpedoed by the Tea Party, which just said, no, we're not going to allow it, and they just put a stop to it. And that could have set us on the right trajectory. And we're not even talking about it now. The U.S. has thrived all these years, you know, for more than 200 years on the rich injection of immigrants from all over the globe, you know, and the talents that they bring and the skills and the enthusiasm they bring coming to America. And it's like we just aren't talking about the value of that anymore.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Mike Spain, and J.P. Miller. We welcome your letters. We'll get to those in just a few moments. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. And we will continue after this short news break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning and getting ready for the snow to fly, but we've got a lot to talk about. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Mike Spain, and J.P. Miller, and we welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We have a few letters. We'll get to those, and then we'll move on and talk about other stuff. Tom writes to us from Queensbury and says, good morning, all. $1.3 billion for 55 miles of fencing works out to $4,735 per foot. Very expensive fencing, and I think this will be a lot more than fencing, and I think much more than 55 miles comments.
Well, they say the term bollard-style wall. And I didn't know what that was, so I looked it up on the interweb thing.
Of course you did.
And, you know, it does, in the photo of one story I found about it, it is a pretty substantial fence. It's high, and it's fortified. So it's probably a compromise.
And we are talking about the federal government, remember.
Right. So it's not going to come at the cheapest. You're not going to get it wholesale, right?
And they have to probably acquire property. I would think there are
some aspects of this agreement, though, that protect some environmentally sensitive areas, and that was one of the big arguments against a border wall too. That some places it's just impractical and harmful to the environment. So maybe that'll be reflected by what happens.
And Mike, think of what Tom from Queensbury wrote to us when he said that. It's $5,000 per foot. Very expensive. Very expensive fence.
Well, it should be a good one then, right, Alan?
You get what you pay for, after
That's
all.
Right. Quality, Russ, only the best.
Russ, right. We have the best walls.
I'd like to know who the contractors are.
I think the Defense Department used to have $5,000 toilets, right?
And hammers. Hammers were several thousand dollars also.
Yeah. No. JP, I think you got it wrong. I do, and I'm sorry to have to correct you. It was $5,000 per toilet seat.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's right, Alan.
I'm sorry.
You remember.
Yeah, and then the hammers and all that. Well, Russ from Menands checked in and said the wall will be a good case study of how Trump handles being cornered. Will he go extra legal by declaring an emergency? Does his command over the army trump the legislative process? Or will he be satisfied with some wall and normal legislative process? My guess is that it's the beginning of an autocracy.
I mean, some people are worried about that, but my guess is that he's going to somehow make this a win. He's very good at that. He's going to portray it as a win. If he does agree to it, it's going to be, like Lindsey Graham said, a down payment on the wall. This will get the wall. We will build the wall. He'll keep chanting for it, and he'll use that rhetoric, and he'll demonize the Democrats for not for stopping him and trying to stop him. And the, you know, the government won't shut down, and everybody will be somewhat happy, and he'll somehow make it a win for him.
And it becomes a general election rallying cry. If he goes into 2020 with a full wall, what are his base really voting for? He can now go
finish the wall.
And say,
finish
yes,
the wall.
We've started it. I need to be reelected to finish the job.
Us continue the LBJ theme. You know.
Yeah, I'm hoping we can move on to more interesting or pressing national issues.
Are there other issues?
This is it. Okay, so then Bobby writes, this is about, of course, Beto O'Rourke, as Alan mentioned, had the counter rally last night. And Bobby says, I think a Amy Klobuchar for president and Beto O'Rourke for vice president ticket would be amazing. I think candidates from the middle of the country are what is needed on the ticket.
Well, Amy Klobuchar certainly is pointing out that she is from the center of the United States, even though politically she may be a little off-center, left of center, not a lot, but a little. I think that sells. I do. I think that's really what people are looking for.
My only experience with Klobuchar really was watching her during the Kavanaugh hearings, and I thought she did a really tremendous job of being both tough on Kavanaugh but also not being
partisan.
Overly partisan. I was very impressed with her during the Kavanaugh hearings.
Can I voice, while we're talking about this, can I just say that, and I'll ask Judy this question because I want to basically influence the answer. But doesn't it seem, the only thing that I heard in the Klobuchar, when Amy Klobuchar, the constant stories, and even in the New York Times, the constant stories about her being difficult to work with.
Exactly.
I get it. I understand it. But why? And for anyone who's not familiar, apparently there was something, even though no one really has said anything on the record, there was a story that she got mad and she threw a binder out the window. And then she's very difficult to work with, and that's been brought up. And I just hear it over and over and over again. And you don't hear about Cory Booker's temper tantrums. You don't hear about John Kasich's temper tantrums. And I'm just curious as to what you make of that, Judy.
That is exactly true. And whenever you have a woman in power,
I led the jury.
And whenever you have a woman in power, whenever they attempt to assert themselves, they are viewed as bitchy. And it is a fine line we walk. Because you don't want to come off as bitchy, because that is a way to lessen your strength.
So now let me ask the political scientist on the program: Can you then? And I'll ask both of you: Can you then get over that? In the sense of, if that's what they're going to write about you from the very beginning, is it possible for you to stay on message and to make contact with the American people when you are perceived that way?
Well, you know, she took the bull by the horns yesterday, and she said, yes, I am exacting, or something like that.
Demanding.
In terms of what I expect from staff. You know, I hate to say this, but everybody knows that all it takes is one person, as we used to say, who is Jito, presidential assassin, one disappointed office seeker. You know, to put this stuff out there. But I agree with Judy. I think that this is as sexist as it gets.
So how long will it take before we can look past this and stop demonizing women? I think maybe 25 years. It's discouraging to me, but I think that's the truth.
It's frustrating even in outlets that, because I was listening to the NPR report yesterday, and they were talking about, it was about the snow. She did it on the Mississippi River, right? And the opening announcement. And they're talking about the snow clinging to her long hair that was on her green coat or a tan coat. And I just, what
coat was Beto O'Rourke wearing last night? Or what color shirt in El Paso was he
wearing? And I just think, you know, why? I don't know.
We all criticize that. That's a common criticism, that the media focuses on the hairstyle, the makeup, the dress, the appearance of the women candidate, and they don't do it for the men. And here they do it again and again and again.
But I think also it's a reflection of what what, unfortunately, people care about. I think people write about it because people are interested in what is being worn.
What kind of suit was Trump wearing last night?
No, you're right. You know, well, that's what I mean.
Was he wearing one of those really long red ties, or was it one of those really long blue ties?
You know, it was true.
Well, that is fascinating. I do have to say that is fascinating.
It's the same tie. You know, when Nancy Pelosi emerged from her meeting with Trump and Senator Schumer, sure, there was a lot of news about the particular coat she had, and the manufacturer of that coat put it back in stock because everybody wanted that coat because it made her look strong and powerful. And it's hard for me as a woman to say, okay, some people are interested in fashion, and this is really interesting, and it seemed like a power coat. But I can't remember what Senator Schumer was wearing. I actually didn't care what coat she had on. It looked warm to me, but I'm not a fashion person. This isn't just in politics. This is at every level of our society. When you think about the women who are principals in schools or running companies, they are getting this as well. This is not just politics. And until we stop that, it's not going to stop at politics.
It is tough for the media as well. Like I remember after the State of the Union, you know, a number of the members of Congress were wearing suffragette white. And then there were stories saying that Tiffany Trump's daughter, was also wearing white. Was that an homage to the other women wearing white? And then Melania was wearing black. So there is all of a sudden the storyline.
What would you call that?
there's all of a sudden the storyline about what they're wearing, and you know it's sexist when you read it, yet it's out there all over the place.
And indeed, people are interested in it. Those kinds of social media tweets get a lot of traction.
Well, do you want a presidential candidate who is very, very, very demanding and expects an awful lot from the people that work for her? I think you do.
I agree. And this storyline on Klobuchar, it may seem like a negative story now, but she can turn it into a huge positive on the debate stage of being tough and assertive. And she can turn this into a positive, I hope.
And also overcoming it being an issue. Just isn't it? She can make that a positive as well. We just have time for a letter or two. I'll do those. Tom wrote us a poem. We always love that.
Really?
Yeah. Well, we always love that? Yeah. Well, good point, Judy. But we like this one. Tom is in Connecticut. What is a wall and what is a fence? Why does it matter and does it make sense? Shouldn't crumbling roads and care for the ill deserve more attention on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, bravo.
That's a cute one.
Yeah.
And Richard DeMise writes to us, good morning, panel. As the saying goes, if you compromise with an idiot, does that make you an idiot? Otis, Rick, and Beckett.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I mean, I think you compromise is good, right? I mean, we gotta keep the government open.
You know, there was, I think one of you brought up the point. There's something very positive about what happened. There was compromise. There was actual compromise. You know, as you were saying, JP, both sides are feeling pain. They gave up something for the better good.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Feel free to write your poem, roundtable@wamc.org.
Or limerick.
We made, right, there wasn't. Yeah. Oh, never mind. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Tuesday morning. It's the 12th of February. Just a quick shout out. It is we have a wonderful producer of this program. Her name is Sarah LaDuke, and she is just an essential part. It is her birthday today, so I would like wish her a very, very happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
And she shares a birthday with Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln and Charles Darwin.
Wow.
How cool is that?
Of course.
Yeah,
Sarah's pretty special.
Yes, indeed she is. So we wish Sarah a very, very happy birthday. Okay, we have a couple letters. We'll do those. Then we'll move on to some other stuff. Let us talk. Reed of Bearsville says the question we should be asking, who benefits from the wall? Who are the winners? If the government is supposed to promote the common good, how does the wall fulfill this goal? Well,
I think
well, you know. You know, as Aunt Ruth used to say.
Aunt Ruth.
You know, the last thing we heard before we went to break was what was good for the American people. frankly, I don't think these guys give a damn about what is good for the American people. I think they care about what's good for them. And I think if you want to explain the so-called compromise, you better believe that that's what was going on. It wasn't about the American people. It wasn't about the general good. It was about, I'm going to lose my office if I don't behave here.
But the reason they would lose their office is because if there's another shutdown, people are going to be really angry and they're going to vote them out of office. So in protecting their own hides, they end up doing something that actually isn't bad.
Yes, but their primary concern, Mikey, is what's good for them as opposed to what's good for the general public. Because if it was good for the general public, about nine-tenths of this nonsense would never be happening.
Well, I don't disagree with you there.
All right. Mark writes, good morning, panel. According to many reliable media sources, America's fertility rate is declining and it won't recover. Why are we building walls to keep people out when we should be focusing on how to get people in? Canada has recognized this issue for themselves and they have forward-looking immigration policy. Why aren't Democrats talking about this?
Well, you can only imagine that you're a Democrat and that you go before your electorate and you say, We need more people in the United States, which we do, to put into Social Security and all of those funds that we have that are now going to be declining because we don't have enough people working to support the older people in the country. And you can imagine how appreciative the American people would be for such rhetoric. They would hate it.
Mm-hmm. Well, they also, I think most Americans believe that legal immigration is encouraged, we should increase it, and that's a good thing. What Trump has really exposed in his election and his presidency is the deep divisions over illegal immigration, and that's really a great issue for him to hit again and again and again.
But I think that the result of that and demonizing the bad hombres that he referred to when he announced his candidacy for president a couple years ago is that people, when they think of immigrants, they think of like Syrian refugees who are going to come in here and they're actually terrorists and bad people who are going to murder and rape people. And there's already a very, very negative tone when you're thinking about immigrants. And yet you go into your professional offices. If you go in for a physician, it's somebody from another country very often. If you go in for a specialty in certain fields, it's another country. I mean, we thrive on this.
Damn, Mike, I have to say I agree with you.
I'm sorry about that, but I guess we do it now and then.
Please apologize.
All right. Let's go to Richard, who says, nobody is saying Gillibrand, Warren, or Harris are difficult. This is really not sexist, in my opinion.
Just wait.
Roger says, the focus of the New York Times on Klobuchar's toughness is not unlike their focus on Hillary's emails. It was incessant and, to me, inexplicable. Matt says, it's not misogynistic to tell the truth about Klobuchar being a horrible boss. Making adults pick up your dirty clothes is awful regardless whether you are a man or a woman. Michael says, historians agree that LBJ was tough to work with. He left a legacy of great accomplishments. Being tough may not be so bad. Ann says, Amy Klobuchar was interviewed by Rachel Maddow last evening. She was terrific. Rachel asked her about the allegations regarding her staff turnover. Klobuchar acquitted herself beautifully. Also, she emphasized her accomplishments in the Senate, many being the results of her ability to work across the aisle. This talent is apparently widely acknowledged. Someone with an out-of-control temper could not succeed in that way. And we also got a letter that I wanted to read, but I do have to find it first, which was... this is from... I'm sorry. It's from John, who says, good morning, panel. If I had a dime for every time the media has mentioned Trump's weight, I'd be as rich as him. Please be objective. And Denise says, I hope that you'll remember to cover the worsening crisis in Puerto Rico. Trump has talked about redirecting recovery funds meant for the island to his wall. Money for food support is due to run out next month, and now parts of the island are enduring drought and water rationing.
Apparently, that was supposed to be part of this bipartisan agreement they reached last night, but they decided to wait another day to resolve the aid to especially Puerto Rico.
To do it separately.
Right.
All right. Let's move on to another topic, if we may. We will talk about the Representative Ilhan Omar. And I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. Ilhan Omar has apologized for statements condemned as anti-Semitic. Representative Omar, who has been battling charges of anti-Semitism for weeks, apologized on Monday for insinuating that American support for Israel is fueled by money from a pro-Israel lobbying group, a comment that drew swift and unqualified condemnation from fellow Democrats, including the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. The mea culpa by Ms. Omar, a freshman lawmaker from Minnesota and one of the first two Muslim women elected to Congress, came after a day of bipartisan outrage over her tweet Sunday, asserting that support for Israel was all about Benjamin's baby, a reference to $100 bills. Alan, we'll go to you first.
Why?
I think okay, you know okay. why.
Okay. All right. You know, there is the potential for widespread anti-Semitism in this country, and we know it's happening. That's why we have an Anti-Defamation League, and always needed it. It's unfortunate that this happened, because it really is something that every American is going to find an anathema. Because what it does is we can all get over the fact that, okay, so this is an anti-Semitic remark, which it certainly was. But then, you know, they came for you, and who was left? There's always the next one that comes after. So you pick on the Jews first. We know how it happened. It happened in Germany. We saw it. It is disgusting. And she apologized. Why? Because I believe, truly believe, they're going to kick her out of the House otherwise.
Well, we saw what happened with Steve King, the Republican from Iowa. Finally, the Republicans themselves kind of dethroned him. They took him off his committees and publicly punished and repudiated his behavior and his comments. I think knowing that just happened, she had a very, very rapid indoctrination.
I was going to say that she's a month into her term, for goodness sake.
Yeah. I mean, But her apology and her reversal on this was profound. I mean, there was complete acknowledgement of wrongdoing, and that's something you didn't see from Steve King. We're going to talk about the Virginia situation, I know. I mean, it's begging the whole question. Can someone be stupid and make a stupid mistake, acknowledge it, and be forgiven and grow from it? I don't know.
Well, as I look at this congresswoman, I don't see a stupid mistake from 10 or 20 years ago that someone uncovered in an old paper of hers.
She was a teenager 10 or 20 years ago.
Right. Well, 5 years ago, however long ago, but she is a member of Congress. She was not caught on tape. This is a well thought out position of hers of how she feels about Israel and about how a growing number of people in the progressive movement feel about Israel. There's two issues here, though.
One is that, but the other is that she made this remark that it was basically a well-moneyed lobbyist, and that's why Americans support Israel, because we're influenced by well-moneyed lobbyists. We're saying that about Russians. We're saying Americans were influenced by Russians, and that's onerous. So to equate the two, I think, was quite offensive to so many people for obvious reasons.
Right, this is a well-thought-out position of hers.
About Palestine rights.
So she has this well-thought-out position, and all of a sudden she's totally come to, you know, be enlightened as to what the real case is. I think she probably still feels this way, but she got scared into apologizing.
It was classic anti-Semitism, because one can think what they want about Israel. Hey, look, I'm not a Netanyahu fan. I'm never going to be a Netanyahu fan. I think they've made big mistakes. Nevertheless, that's Israel. When you say it's American Jewry or Jews,
wealthy American Jews that are
driving this, that's anti-Semitism, and that needs to be dealt with harshly.
Right. It's not so much the positions that she was taking. It was how she was articulating it and perpetuating very negative stereotypes. tips about money Jews being puppet masters that actually what's happening in American politics. This is something you hear on conspiracy websites all the time. And I think that not so subtle tweet, wasn't it a tweet?
Yeah, it was where she said they're using a lot of Benjamins, meaning $100 bills.
Yeah, that is, and the hot word now is trope. That trope is what really got her in a world of trouble.
So what happens in her district? After all, she's an elected congressperson. Will this turn people off, or like Trump appealing to his base, will that somehow be an appeal to her base?
And again, it means we can't really have a real discussion about what's happening in Israel and Palestine because we're stuck on this.
And that's a discussion that's completely legitimate. I agree with you, JP. I mean, that that's probably where she has strong feelings, but for her to be so, I guess, clueless and uneducated about the way that she, without realizing it, perhaps, I'll give her that, perhaps she didn't realize it, to attack and perpetuate a very negative stereotype like she did was just, you know, it'll be interesting to see if she can come back for a re-election time. It depends on the makeup of her district, which is probably pretty urban and probably has is quite diverse.
All right, let's stop there. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have a good one going. Alan Chartok is here, Judy Patrick, Mike Spain, and J.P. Miller. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will return right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice that we are back with you. And we thank you for a wonderful fun drive yesterday. And it is great to have a program this morning. We have a lot of things to talk about. We will do a few letters and then we'll get into more topics, if that's okay. We go to Elaine, who said, concerned I may have missed something. Has NPR or PBS been inside Venezuela this week to confirm whether there is a humanitarian crisis? Does Maduro contend the U.S. is making up the crisis? I don't put it past the Trump administration, but what is the truth?
I think the press has been inside Venezuela, yeah. And it has documented the starvation that's happening there. I mean, food is scarce. I've seen a video of empty grocery stores, and one of the other issues is the inflation, the hyperinflation means that people can't afford to buy what food there is.
Yeah, no, I've also seen those reports. It's a pretty grim situation inside Venezuela right now, and you know, what the U.S. does is really important because you certainly want to get aid. There's aid on the way, but it can't get across the border to where it would help people because Maduro is portraying it as a way for the U.S. to kind of manipulate the country, and yet it's needed. And that's a very volatile situation down there, and it's I'm afraid for how it might turn out. You know.
We got this letter from Mike who says, this is about Ilhan Omar's statement. I'll bet my bottom dollar that that's not Omar's last anti-Semitic statement. She has an ideology that doesn't belong in American politics. She's not sorry. She's saving face.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Judy writes, I'm sick of politicians' lame and phony excuses when they get caught making divisive, clueless, and insulting remarks against Jews, African Americans, and anybody else they hate. Lock her out. We don't need this. That from Judy.
Well, there has been a flurry of them recently, hasn't there?
Yes. And Jay says, I don't understand what is anti-Semitic about Representative Omar's remarks. I want to say I'm Jewish. Yes, her comment referred to money. Yes, there are anti-Semites who make negative comments about Jews and money. But do you really think we'd be supporting Israel so slavishly if we weren't selling so much defense hardware to Israel, or that if there weren't major lobbying groups wanting money to go to Israel, that the support the U.S. gives them wouldn't be less? Or maybe the U.S. might be working harder to get Israel to stop building settlements in the West Bank. Dan writes, good morning, panel. I just tuned in the middle of your commentary about the Congresswoman's anti-Semitic comments, and I'm not aware of her actual quote, but from what I heard, you all talking about it, sounds like she blamed us, U.S. policy towards Israel on wealthy American Jewish lobbyists. With people like the Adelsons having such inside connections in their politics, do you really think her perspective is that off the mark? For the record, I'm not agreeing with her or condoning that perspective. I am just curious. Anybody want to weigh in on that?
Well, certainly the offensive way that she stated it, it has to be a factor in this, too. I mean, if you raise a question about whether legitimate lobbying is going on, you know, and that has an undue influence, that's a topic that certainly can be discussed. But I think some people are underestimating how offensive it is to just make it in a couple of words. They're just wealthy Jews throwing around money. I mean, that's essentially what she said, and that's causing the U.S. policy to be what it is, and that alone so scathingly describes something that's nuanced. You can't, as somebody said today, I heard say, there's not much nuance in a Twitter tweet. So right. Yeah.
As I said before, go back to Hitler, see what they were saying about the Jews and their undue influence in the country, and I think you'll get what's going on here.
But you see, you're providing context and historical perspective, Alan, and that's not so easy.
Yeah, we don't want to do that.
Yeah.
And it should be noted that for Christians, the importance of Israel as a Jewish state is also an important and a very important part of what a lot of Christians support. I mean, they view it as the Holy Land, and they want it to remain. You know, they support Israel's efforts. And so this is not just a Jewish cause, and I think that's what, in part, what that tweet was meant to convey.
All right, so continuing with politicians under fire, we go to Richmond, Virginia. Black lawmakers threatened to scuttle the General Assembly's budget deal Monday, and staffers resigned from the lieutenant governor's office as Virginia's political scandals began affecting the operation of government. The executive branch seemed frozen in a state of suspended calamity, with its three leaders holding on to office despite widespread calls for resignation and no clear mechanism for moving them out. An effort to consider impeaching Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax over sexual assault allegations went nowhere, as lawmakers pointed out that he denies the charges and there is no obvious way to commission an investigation. Meanwhile, Governor Ralph Northam and Attorney General Mark Herring are under fire for racist incidents from their past, but they have not been accused of crimes that would rise to the level of impeachment. Because Virginia is the only state to prohibit a governor from serving consecutive terms, Northam won't have to answer to voters again. It's up to each man to decide his own political fate, and not one is budging.
You know, this is dangerous because I see this happening going forward. People are going to look at this. And we've had the good fortune to have people voluntarily resign when they do something really, really stupid and racist. And these guys are setting they're lowering the bar even further.
Well, I, the bar has been lowered. I mean, we do have one very high-profile politician in office who has been documented to have said some extraordinarily sexist and racist comments, and even admits abusing women and brags about it, and he seems to get away with it. So maybe this is a situation where they're looking at the president's and his survival and his ability to shrug off these allegations and do the same.
That's a very good point, Mike, because you are exactly right. This guy is racist and sexist, this president. And the Republicans are coming after the Democrats in Virginia. And I don't condone for one second what they've done. But it is interesting. They have very little to say about their own president.
There is the fact that so the yearbook photo is pretty clear. It's kind of a proof. It's a fact. The allegations against the lieutenant governor are allegations, and they haven't really been fully vetted. Mm-hmm. I can understand that. But so there is some justification for not rushing to resign. But it does seem like that entire state government is in turmoil and is not moving forward at all.
Not to be provocative.
Go ahead.
Not at all. But think about this for a second. We live in a racist country, right? Does anybody not acknowledge that this country has been racist consistently from, you know, from the beginning? Okay, so we live in a racist country. We know what happened. I think that racist remarks on the part of the population, racist thoughts, have been going on for a long, long time. And I suspect particularly in a southern state like Virginia, which is getting more and more northern as, you know, Washington takes over and the elite takes over. But don't you think that that has something to do with the fact that this guy can survive?
Well, he also, I think that a part of the reason why he may think he can survive is because polls show him not, his support hasn't totally eroded in the state,
exactly,
which they may in the coming days. He's also getting support. I don't know about support, but for instance, Gayle King interviewed him on Sunday, and she said, quote, she said, "No one, the people that I talk to do not believe he's racist. They think it was a stupid thing, but they don't think he's racist." So he's getting support from some black community members, and he right now doesn't feel enough pressure to have to resign, and that's some elected officials feel the pressure and they do it, some don't and write it out.
But can I also say that he also continues to say dumb things, though? You just wonder if this is
that's
over.
That's the complication here.
Yeah, I mean, if I agree with you. You know, if you come out and you say, okay, I got my act together, this is now going to be my position. But if you let him talk enough, he seems to just keep putting his foot into it.
Yeah, the slaves were not slaves. They were indentured servitude.
Yeah,
they were
indentured
servitude. Unbelievable.
It really is.
Well, in order to, you know, put on blackface and portray yourself as a black performer, which is what he did. Today, I think we know, the whole demeaning aspect of that and how it was used by white performers to make fun of and totally denigrate African Americans or black Americans. And when you understand the context and the history of it, it is just so offensive. I'll give it to you. Maybe he didn't understand it in 1983 when he dressed up as Michael Jackson and did the moonwalk. But today, you have no excuse not for knowing about it. And he continues to kind of, you know, I was going to say dance around it, but that would be wrong. But he you're right, Joe.
Skirt
it. Yeah. I mean, he's just. He still seems not to be fully aware. He's sort of like politely acknowledging how it was the wrong thing to do, but he doesn't seem, I mean, he's not convincing that he understands it.
His wife seems to be the one who understands it and keeps on putting her hand on his shoulder, getting him to stop talking at times. And I just, there's going to be a point where she's not there and he's going to say something even more stupid.
Yeah, I'm still troubled by the fact that at first he said it was him and then he, later said, oh no, that wasn't me.
Yeah, that one, that certainly undermines his credibility. It's confusing. Yeah.
And then what about the lieutenant governor?
Well, as Judy pointed out, those are allegations that they're very difficult. I mean, he's calling, Fairfax, the lieutenant governor, who's been accused of sexual assault and rape by two different women, is calling on the FBI to investigate it. I who has the standing to properly investigate it? Whoever, you know, whatever jurisdiction the alleged crime happened in, I guess, would be the first place it should happen. And then how long will that take? It's not like we had with Brett Kavanaugh, where there was an allegation, a single allegation, and the Republicans were just intent on getting the vote on whether he was going to be go before the full Senate and be nominated for the Supreme Court, approved for the Supreme Court. And it's like a time, you know, it's like a drip, drip, drip. I mean, how long can someone hold a key government position and perform in that position when there's this much, at least very convincing and what appears to be credible allegations against him like this? Even if he were not guilty, and he's claiming he is not guilty, he can't do the job that he was elected to do. Why this hangs over him? And it's not going to be lifted anytime soon, if at all.
I think it also confuses things for him as he makes this decision as to whether to resign or whether to stay, as to who's going to take that position from him. If there was some strong, clean alternative, and I'm not saying these other people aren't clean, but their reputations are muddied with the allegations that are around him and what they've admitted to. So that, I think, confuses things for him as well.
Alan?
You know, I'm interested in the concept of the lieutenant governor's problems and the fact that so many, you know, people are saying, well, how can government continue? I go to the lieutenant governor's job in New York State, maybe I'm naive, and I say, you know, what's that worth? What do they do? So I'm thinking, how in the world will a lieutenant governor stop what is going on as the normal function of government? The governor, I can believe, and I can see somebody writing a letter and saying, oh, come on now, Alan, you know that as long as this hangs over him, people are going to be upset with the government. That's true.
But we wouldn't we wouldn't even be looking at this guy, right? If there wasn't a chance that he would be taking over the top job because Northam goes as a result of his
Some people cynically say, Joe, that the best thing that happened to Northam was what happened to the lieutenant governor.
Well,
because all of a sudden the scene shifted.
Well, the lieutenant governor seemed to blame Northam and said that he was responsible for bringing up the allegations.
I always felt that Spiro Agnew was that for Richard Nixon. Nobody wanted to impeach Nixon when Agnew would become president. They got rid of him, and that cleared the way for impeachment.
Boy, did they ever get rid of him. That was so neat. I have told you the story about being in Spain. And Roselle and I were sitting there. And
I don't think I've heard this one.
Oh, sit down. It's a great one.
And there was a drunk businessman there. Said, what do you think on Nixon? He said, my people who were for him are now getting very angry at him. We got rid of Agnew, and now we're going to get rid of him.
Yeah.
And it happened.
Well, if Fairfax were to resign, it would perhaps clear the way for Northam to step aside, too. Who knows?
Meanwhile, we've been talking about our issues here. We've been talking about what's going on with the wall and how we're going to move forward and a budget and all of that. We've been talking about the state of Virginia. And all of that seems fairly slight compared to the problems of the United Kingdom. Britain is, the economy is faltering. Brexit is looming. There is a deadline for the end of March. And nobody knows what is happening. What we do know is that the fourth quarter shows the British economy growing at its slowest pace since 2012. There are a lot of concerns. What is considered to be a no-deal split from the European Union, I think by most parties involved, say that could be a disaster. And what does that mean for Britain?
Right. Companies are leaving, they're relocating to the continent, as they say over there. But this is important to us as well, because we can't have Britain fail. Britain is such an important part of our economy and the world's economy. It's something we all need to care about. But their dysfunction certainly makes our dysfunction look not so bad.
Yeah. The part I don't quite understand, and maybe somebody has more insight to it, is, you know, there's been these surveys that show that many Brits would like to have a revote, you know, redo.
Right.
And others are very much opposed to it because they say if it's close the other way, it's going to be just as divided. But it seems that that's not going to happen. And the particular story today in the New York Times that you pointed out to us, Joe, brought something home that I wondered about, and that is that, you know, officially the countries across Europe are saying, well, it'd be terrible. We don't want to lose Britain. They're a great partner. And then quietly they're saying, yippee, because they are, in this particular case.
Suddenly that pig in the Geico commercial.
Right.
Go ahead.
They're all benefiting from it because a lot of brick and mortar is moving on to the continent off of the United Kingdom.
Well, we are out of time. My thanks to everybody. Thank you for being with us again. Beautiful thanks to everybody for what they did during the fund drive. And we'll, now we're back to normal, right? Whatever that is.
The The new normal.
The new normal. Alan, thank you very much. Judy.
No, Joe, thank you for everything you've done.
Well,
it's
thank
unbelievable.
You. And Mike and Judy and JP, thank you for coming in this morning. We'll be back after this.